The Health and Human Services Committee will come to order. Cheryl, please call the roll.
Chair Burton?
Here.
Representatives Altman?
Here.
Botana?
Here.
Brown?
Here.
Buchanan?
Here.
Davis?
Here.
Duran?
Here.
Garrison?
Yep.
Grant? Coster?
Here.
Masulo? Mello is excused. Persons Mulica?
Here.
Rayner?
Here.
Rizzo?
Here.
F. Robinson? W. Robinson?
Here.
Saroy?
Here.
Skidmore?
Here.
Tant?
Yes.
Yarbrough?
Here.
Quorum is present.
Thank you, Cheryl. Members and guests, our regular committee announcement, please silence your cell phones or whatever electronic devices you might have with you. And as we begin the meeting, I am happy to pass the gavel to Vice Chair Grant.
Thank you, Chair, and I will reciprocate by recognizing you to present PCB HHS 22-01, COVID-19 Liability Protections Application Extension. You are recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Members, as you'll recall, in 2021, we passed Senate Bill 74, which provided heightened civil liability protections to healthcare providers for COVID-19 related claims. These liability protections apply to claims that accrued before the effective date of Senate Bill 74 and within 1 year of the effective date. You'll also recall that Senate Bill 74 became law on March 21st, 2021, meaning that these liability protections will not apply to any claims that accrue after March 21, 2022. Optimistically, I think we all hoped that the pandemic would be in its final days by this coming March, but unfortunately, we also are quite aware that new mutations of the COVID-19 virus continue to prolong the pandemic. It is vitally important that we continue to protect our frontline workers as they fight the pandemic. What the bill does is extends the heightened civil liability protections for healthcare entities to apply to all claims that accrue before June 1, 2023. This application period is consistent with the COVID liability law HB 1 that was passed during special session, which also expires on June 1, 2023. And Mr. Chair and members, that is the bill.
Members, having heard the bill, are there questions? Are there questions of the chair? Representative, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question, Representative. Good morning. Have we had, can you tell us of any cases that have been brought forth at this point?
Recognized.
Thank you. I don't have that data. So no, I can't tell you.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Davis, you're recognized for follow-up.
Thank you. So in your opening, you made sure you said this bill was brought to protect our frontline workers. But in the writing or the explanation of the bill, it also comes back to say this is, in most part, a protection for health care entities. Can you make the difference for us? Are these protections for the workers that are inside the facilities, our frontline workers, or is this a protection for the health care facilities?
Thank you. The bill that you're looking at today extends the same privilege, or excuse me, the same protections that we passed last session in SB 74. So it protects the entities that are where healthcare workers are working, and therefore it certainly protects the workers as well.
Members, further questions? We have public testimony. We have Laura Yeomans. Laura? From Florida Justice Association, you're recognized.
Justice Association. We would ask you to vote no on this bill today. Unfortunately, our victim that we had the opportunity to see speak yesterday and rules on this committee wasn't able to be here, but I'd like to convey her story to you as an example of the consequences of this bill. Jennifer Barassa is a Floridian, and her brother, a 30-year-old, also a Floridian, suffered from COVID, went to the hospital, and unfortunately passed away due to medical complications. He was improperly ventilated. Because of this bill, they are not, because of this existing law, they are not able to bring a claim. So these cases are being prevented from being brought. They have, this bill has lowered the standard of care, not just for people that have COVID, that are going in and presenting with COVID symptoms, but they're also lowering the standard of care for people in, that are trying to come in to healthcare facilities, anyone that comes in with an emergency condition, anyone that comes in for routine care, and anyone that comes in for preventative care. This law is being applied to any cases that are coming forward for medical malpractice. Additionally, the perception that this law creates is that the pandemic is continuing. It creates a perception among citizens, people that need to go to the hospital, people that need to get medical treatment, that they're not going to be given the same standard of care that they would be given outside of the protections of this law. That perception is not in the public interest. We would hope that we would be out of the pandemic. We think that we should be able to have PPE. We should be having staff that are able to care for these people. But this bill provides complete immunity in the event that a hospital, nursing home, or any medical facility alleges that they're unable to get PPE or staffing. This bill is not moving us forward to getting back to business. We think that the best way to get back to business is to get back to normal, and get back to an acceptance that Floridians deserve the highest standard of care when they go to the doctor, when they go to the hospital, or in a nursing home. So we would ask for you to vote against this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have William Lodge from Florida Justice Reform Institute. Mr. Lodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Very simply, we supported this bill last year. We support it this year. All it does is extend the protections for an additional 14 months as healthcare providers throughout the state deal with this pandemic. So we'd ask for your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lodge. Next up, we have David Mica, Florida Hospital Association. Mr. Mica, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David Mica, Jr., on behalf of the Florida Hospital Association. We represent more than 200 hospitals across the state of Florida. And I'd like to be clear real quick. This does not lower the standard of care. All it does is increase the provision of the protections that are allowed for us under that liability. Florida's hospitals have been committed, as they have been for hundreds of years, but especially over the last 2 years, of providing the top-line service. And our frontline workers are taxed on every single way that they can. And what we hope is that in this limited exception that you all provided last year, that we can extend that to protect against frivolous lawsuits in that sense and keep our focus where it needs to be. Thank you for your support on the bill and ask to, for your favorable vote. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Next up, we have Hayden Dempsey, Leading Age of Florida. Don't see Mr. Dempsey. He is a proponent. Next, we have Sherry Hickey from the Florida Medical Association. Don't see Sherry. Wave in support. Jason Hand, Florida Senior Living Association, waves in support. Martin Lyon, Florida Osteopathic Medical Association, waves in support. Timothy Nungasser, National Federation of Independent Businesses, waves in support. Rebecca Bush, Florida Healthcare Association. Wave in opposition. I'm sorry, wave in support. I was wondering about that one. Carolyn Johnson, Florida Chamber of Commerce, wave in support. Aaron Potts, Florida Assisted Living Association, wave in support. Dr. Rich Templeton. You're recognized, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Florida FL-CIO, we actually represent tens of thousands of healthcare workers across the state. And we really look at this as a workplace safety issue. You know, when this bill passed the first time, there was a lot of talk about the emergency of the pandemic. There was a lot of talk about how this came out of nowhere and our healthcare providers were unable to keep up with changing regulations and changing rules, and that's why we had to have this. That's not the case anymore. It's been 2 years. 2 years that a new substance has been introduced into the workplace. That means that all of these employers have had 2 years to figure out how to mitigate this new hazardous substance in the workplace. If they have not, then they should face the same obligations that any other employer has for not managing a new hazardous substance in the workplace. We believe that the passage of this legislation and the extension of this liability is only going to add to businesses, for-profit, money-making enterprises, to cut corners when it comes to worker safety, when it comes to this newly introduced hazardous substance into the workplace. We ask that these liability protections be allowed to expire so that employers will know that they have an obligation to keep their workers safe and implement all of the strategies that we have learned over the last 2 years keep people from getting the virus, from getting sick, from getting ill, and from having any reason for damages to begin with. This was an emergency measure. A lot of compelling arguments were made about the emergency nature of the measure. That emergency has passed. We now have to get to the work of keeping people, employees, workers safe from this newly introduced hazardous substance. So we urge you to let these liability protections expire so that we don't incentivize for-profit companies to cut corners when it comes to worker safety. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, that concludes public testimony. For your information, we had no amendments on this bill, so now we are into debate. Is there any debate on the bill? Representative Skidmore?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Burton, for the bill. I supported this legislation last session, and I think that it has relevance, but I also am concerned about sort of the contradictory narrative that comes from the state. When we tell businesses they have no authority to require vaccines or require masks, and we keep pushing that information out, we keep pushing out that it's not, that this is over, that we need to be back to normal, and yet we sponsor legislation and we have legislation that extends these liability protections. I am going to continue to support this legislation because my community wants me to, but I think that it's important that we sort of say publicly that there's a little bit of a contradictory narrative that is coming from the state, and we should try to get all on the same page.
General Masullo, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Burton, thank you for bringing this bill. I think the healthcare entities need this protection. It was asked even last year what the term would be, and unfortunately, we do have to extend it. My prayer is we won't have to extend it again. And we have faced COVID for the last 2 years, but COVID is a very dynamic situation. The standards of care are continuing to change, and there is still liability in those healthcare workplaces for gross negligence, for people that are treated improperly based on what the standard of care is at that time. But it is changing, and it will continue to change as this disease evolves to the point where it will be endemic. And unfortunately, I'm sad to say most of us will have it in some way, shape, or form, whether it will be symptomatic or not. And healthcare entities can require their personnel to use PPE, mask, and other type of protective devices, regardless of vaccine status. So I'm in fully support of this bill, and I ask the rest of the members to do so as well.
Representative Tant, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last year I struggled with this, and I continue to struggle with it, because in my community in Tallahassee, our super spreader site was was a facility for people with developmental disabilities at which 72 people died. So I can't vote for this bill because this happened in my community. I do believe things have changed quite a bit. At the beginning, we didn't have access to PPE. We didn't have access to testing equipment. We didn't have, and then when we did, still some of it wasn't used, particularly at the facility I'm the most concerned about. So that's why I'm going to be voting no on this bill today. Thank you.
Members, is there further debate? Further debate on the bill? If not, Chair Burton, would you like to close on your bill?
Thank you, Chair. Members, I would just really would be echoing the comments made by Representative Chair Masulu. We are in a dynamic situation, so I'd ask your support to recognize that by extending the date for up to June 1, 2023. Thank you.
Having closed on the bill, Cheryl, please call the roll on PCB HHS 22-01 and announce the vote.
Representatives Altman?
Yes.
Botana?
Yes.
Brown?
No.
Buchanan?
Yes.
Burton?
Yes.
Davis?
No.
Duran?
Yes.
Garrison?
Yes.
Koster?
Yes.
Masulu?
Yes.
Persons Mullica?
Yes.
Rayner?
No.
Rizzo?
Yes.
F. Robinson?
No.
W. Robinson?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Skidmore?
Yes.
Tant?
No.
Yarbrough?
Yes.
Vice Chair Grant?
Yes.
15 yays. 5 nays.
Please show that the bill is reported favorably. Madam Chair, the gavel is yours again.
Thank you. Excuse us, Krista. All right, members, you will have seen on your agenda today that we have a presentation. In 2020, legislation was passed that required DCF and ACA to start reporting on involuntary mental health examinations of children under the Baker Act. We suspected that we had a problem, and with the number of children who are Baker Acted repeatedly, pointing to possible gaps in care. The ACA and DCF report confirmed our concerns. Today, we have ACA and DCF here to brief us on that data and report on the actions they've taken to improve the situation for children. With us today is Tom Wallace, Deputy Secretary of Medicaid at ACA, and Erica Floyd Thomas, Assistant Secretary for Substance Abuse and Mental Health at DCF. So we'll begin by recognizing both of you and thanking both of you for being here. And Secretary Thomas, you are recognized.
Good morning, Chair Burton and Vice Chair Grant and Ranking Member Davis. Thank you for allowing us to be here today to present on the bill. So, of course, I'm here with my colleague, Tom Walls at Medicaid, and we want to discuss the efforts that are underway.
Ma'am. Do you have a presentation that should be on a screen?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, there's always that. There we go. Thank you.
Thank you for reminding me of that. I was so excited when to jump right in. So I want to talk a little bit about what we've done with House Bill 945. So House Bill 945 did task the agency and the department with identifying children and adolescents who were the highest utilizers of crisis services. So it asked us to do a couple of things, to work collaboratively, to look at actions and resources, to effectively determine what the needs were for these kids. We have been submitting reports quarterly, and we continue to do that. So that's what we were tasked to do. A little bit about our system. So the DCF and ACA Behavioral System of Care, the department and the agency are part of Florida's Behavioral System of Care and designed to provide mental health services, substance abuse services, supports recovery-oriented care for children and adults, focusing on efforts on improving outcomes for those stabilizing those in crisis. The department is the single state authority for substance abuse and mental health and the state opioid treatment authority. The Agency for Healthcare Administration is the single state agency responsible for overseeing the Florida Medicaid program. Both of our agencies have unique roles in the behavioral health system of care, generally structured by federal law based upon specific funding requirements. The Department of Children and Families' role is the safety net. We are responsible for the oversight of a statewide system of care, prevention services, treatment services, recovery for children and adults with serious mental illness or substance abuse disorder. We provide services to those who are uninsured or underinsured, as defined by our block grant. DCF Safety Net. This slide demonstrates our partnership that we have with our managing entities. We have 7 managing entities that are under contract. The purpose of our managing entities is to plan, to provide, to coordinate, and to subcontract for the delivery of community mental health services, for substance use services, to improve access to care, and to provide continuity of care, purchase services, and support effective and efficient delivery of services. The managing entities coordinate these things through providing services such as assessments, evaluation, outpatient therapy services, case management, residential treatment, peer support services, crisis stabilization services, mobile response services, and other social supports such as supported housing, supported employment, and vouchers for incidentals such as clothing, transportation, or education. Florida Medicaid is a single state agency and has a federal partnership that provides health coverage for individuals who are low income that qualify. The purpose is to improve health care for individuals, including behavioral health, for those who would otherwise go without care. Currently, Florida Medicaid is providing services to more than 5 million individuals. Since 2014, most of Florida Medicaid recipients have been enrolled in the statewide Medicaid Managed Care Program. The health plans provide comprehensive services, which include medical services such as doctor's visits, hospital care, prescribed drugs, behavioral health care that ranges from assessments to evaluations, inpatient and acute care, along with transportation to these services. Additionally, Medicaid has established specialty plans that provide a general focus, a specific focus on higher level needs for chronic conditions or specific diagnosis. The state Medicaid Managed Care Plan program includes services for children that are in the child welfare system, and recipients are those who have serious mental illness. So as a result of the work of House Bill 945, we begin to examine the Baker Act process to better identify the children who were impacted and you were using crisis services, and why were they using these crisis services. Before we get into that, I want to discuss what the Baker Act is. The Baker Act is a process established to provide emergency behavioral health services for individuals who cannot or will not get help for themselves. These emergency services are designed to stabilize an immediate crisis. The Baker Act's maximum length of stay for the initial examination period is 72 hours. Discharge is required to occur as soon as the patient is stabilized. Then the individual may elect to receive care in the community. This process can be initiated by a number of individuals, by law enforcement officers, licensed clinical practitioners, or through the use of a court order. The Agency for Healthcare Administration is responsible for the licensure of crisis stabilization units that are designated as Baker Act receiving facilities. Hospitals may choose to be a Baker Act facility or receiving facility, and also for the licensure of short-term residential facilities. The department is responsible for designating any private or public facility and granting them the ability to hold individuals on an emergency basis for a psychiatric evaluation. The next few slides will provide just an overview of our statewide Baker Act data. So in calendar year 2020, you see that there are a total of 94,687 Baker Acts. This was a decrease from 2019, which was a decrease by 8%. Of those, 35,068 were children under the age of 18. A child is most likely to be Baker Acted by a law enforcement officer or physician, and the most frequent reason for a child being Baker Acted is for having thoughts of self-harm. This slide shows you the data by county for children who were Baker Acted. We felt that this was very important to look at it by county so we could have a better understanding of pockets or areas where we could provide deeper intervention to figure out specifically what could be done to move the needle forward with providing the appropriate care. So this is what it looks like for the 2019 period, and here is what it looks like for 2020. So the percent of individuals with repeat Baker Acts, so the data demonstrated on this slide shows that less than 1/4 of our children and young adults are repeatedly Baker Acted. This data includes any Baker Act. So this actually goes for anyone who had more than just one Baker Act, as you can see, within the calendar year. And that's important to emphasize because next we'll talk about how we've defined those who are high utilizers of crisis services. So high utilizers of crisis services. The term high utilizers was used to describe the children and youth who frequently require crisis services that are three or more in a six-month period. This definition was jointly established by the department and by ACA. It was based upon previous work that the department had done working through with adults who were cycling in and out of crisis stabilization units. And based upon that, it was also a definition that was incorporated into one of our rules. We felt that this was a good baseline to start with to determine how to approach this. So we were looking at those who were 18 under who had more than three Baker Acts. So the total number of high utilizers. So this is our combined data, and it talks about our total number of high utilizers. So we wanted to make sure that we had the most accurate data or most current data available. So that's why we use a calendar year. The goal really for us was to be able to intervene with the child and their families as we were doing this work on the report. The statewide total for numbers of the children who met the definition of high utilizers is 1,156. As reflected in the data, most of the children were enrolled in Florida Medicaid. There were 10 children in this time period that received care in both delivery systems. Families often transition between our systems based upon their financial status, so you see that noted on the slide. So during calendar year 2020, the children who were served through the safety net totaled 2,052, and of those, there were 89 children who had three or more Baker Acts within a six-month period. This slide demonstrates that girls are more likely to use crisis services more frequently than boys. The data identifies for us that interventions and services should focus on a target age group. We should focus our efforts for children ranging 10 and under to be able to resolve that crisis. As we examine our data, we begin to look at the diagnosis for those who are high utilizers. There were three primary diagnoses in the GCF data of the 89 children. The first was disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, which is characterized by intense mood swings from depression to mania. The next is mental health disorder, otherwise not specified. This is generally used when a more specific diagnosis has not been identified. Practitioners are typically cautious before assigning a diagnosis to a child. The third diagnosis that emerged was attention deficit disorder. And this really is for children who, of course, have a number of issues, including impulse control issues, which may lead to thoughts of self-harm. So this is what our top diagnoses were. Next, I'll turn it over to Tom Wall so he can walk through the data.
Thank you. And members, excuse me, I didn't mention what we'll do is we will listen to a presentation by Secretary Wallace as well, and then we'll open for questions from each and every one of you, so I'm sure you're taking notes. All right, thank you. Secretary Wallace, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks for having me here today. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Medicaid data and what we've looked at on the Medicaid side. So for the purposes of the Medicaid analysis, first we wanted to look at and identify all children that had at least one qualifying event during calendar year 2020. And a qualifying event is either a crisis stabilization unit visit or a psychiatric inpatient visit. So we took that pool. So after we looked at that, we took that whole pool of people there and then identified those that had at least three crisis stabilization unit visits or inpatient visits within a 180-day period in calendar year 2020, and we defined that as the high utilizers. So that total, and you heard Erica talk about that, that total was 1,077 children. These are Medicaid children. This includes both the Medicaid children in our managed care plans as well as our fee-for-service program who are identified as high utilizers. So this number has grown since the first quarterly report of House Bill 945 that we've done. And then each quarter, as we collect more data, this is encounter data from the managed care plans and claims data on the fee-for-service side, we add to these numbers, and this is the most recent numbers that we have. This slide is a breakdown of the gender, age, and race of these individuals in our as high utilizers. In terms of gender, you can see that there are more females than males, about 58% female, 42% male. Looking at the age spans from ages 4 through 18, and you can see that beginning at age 12 is where you start to see the spike and the pickup, and really spiking at ages 14 and 15, and then it starts tailing down with the older ages. And then as in terms of race, that's the bottom chart here, you can see the breakdown by race. Because there is not a required field in our Medicaid eligibility, so it's not required to for the individual to put race on that eligibility, we do have some that are non-determined, so you see that there is a high percentage of not determined. So here's another breakdown we wanted to look at, and this is by diagnosis codes. So we identify the top three diagnosis codes by looking at that actual encounter data and claims data, and it's by diagnosis-related groups. This is on the inpatient side. The top three diagnoses that we found in looking at the data were the bipolar disorders. The second was major depressive disorders, depression. And then third was disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. So on the table on the right, this is kind of according to the DRGs, you can see that the top DRG is bipolar disorders, and then affects males at a higher rate than it does females. This slide goes ahead and breaks it down by our Medicaid regions in our state. You know, we have 11 Medicaid regions. So you can see all of our regions listed on the left-hand side in the first column, and then the count by region of the number of high utilizers. You can see regions 9, 10, 11 are your highest. It's the South Florida with the Palm Beach region at 165. It's Palm Beach and the counties north of Palm Beach. That's our highest region of these utilizers. We also wanted to look at this on a kind of normalized basis, and so that's why we have that last factor over there. This is the high utilizers per 100,000 utilizer, just to normalize it by all the counties, like I said, and overall per 100,000 statewide with 0.43. Also, we wanted to look at this by our Medicaid managed care plans. So what you see here is all of our plans listed on the left-hand side with, again, the counts by Medicaid plan. And then also to go ahead and normalize it, just like I just discussed, we did the same thing here for our plans. As you can see on here, we have a couple, or really three, that really stand out, four that really stand out here. And that is, these are the specialty plans that we have in our program. So you can see our Sunshine and Molina serious mental illness plans, as SMI plans. It makes sense that they have a high population of these high utilizers. They are higher along with our child welfare specialty plan. So wanting to break down and look at the by admission, you know, by the number of admissions that all these higher utilizers have done here. So the admissions on the left-hand side with the children by admission, which you can see on here, about majority of these, about 72% had admissions of 6 or less admissions. And again, this is within that 6-month period, that 180-day period that we looked at. Between 7 and 12 admissions, there were 21%. And then the remaining 7% had more than 13 admissions within that 180-day time frame. So the agency maintains the data set here. We're collecting this data on a quarterly basis. It's our encounter and claims data. We have a data set, we maintain that, we update it each quarter. We also take in the DCF data, so we receive that data from DCF. That goes into our data set as well. So we just want to explain that we have a process for obtaining and analyzing the data. So next, I'm going to get in a little more detail on each one of these sections on this pie chart here, but just wanted to look at, you know, what have the health plans been doing? So we'll go ahead and get started and really talk about these focused performance improvement plans. So our Medicaid managed care plans are required to conduct multiple PIPs. These are the performance improvement plans. They're required to do multiple of these throughout the year, and one of them has to be related to mental health. So this past year, the agency required all plans to focus on the same topic. And this topic was increasing the number of members who attended a follow-up visit within 7 days after a hospitalization or an ER visit for mental health. Right, so this also included emergency department visits for mental and substance abuse as well. The first year of the interventions are underway right now, which include enhanced discharge planning and care coordination, promoting the availability of behavioral health services, promoting telehealth services, and then also providing member incentives for completing their follow-up visits after the 7 days. The PIP documentation was submitted by the plans to the agency in October 21, so we had asked the plans to submit this to us, so that was in October. They had submitted that to us. The agency, along with our contracted external quality review organization, is currently reviewing that data. We do anticipate having the preliminary results at the end of end of April, with the final report being done in June of this year. The next action taken here was surveys. So the agency, what we did here, we kind of sent out a survey to our health plans related to Baker Acts. We deployed the survey, and what you can see here is that the greatest barrier that we're hearing the most of is that the caretakers are declining services or the caretakers cannot be reached. Also have some other things here is the enrollee and caregiver difficulty navigating the multiple agencies and the health plan. You know, there's a barrier to care with the communication regarding the needs of the services. We also see, you know, admissions and the Baker Acts are also being initiated in schools where the law enforcement kind of gets involved in that situation. Health plan notification does not occur until the end of the inpatient admission. And then also we have this limited community resources in certain areas due to wait lists, et cetera. And then the last piece of this slide chart or the pie chart here is stakeholder engagement. So one area of opportunity across the continuum of care is the communication among all of our stakeholders. So two recent implemented solutions are described on this slide here. We got two, these are the two biggest ones that we just have kind of implemented. One solution is for the health plans to continue to actively build relationships with the managing entities, these are the MEs, in their regions and partner with these MEs to develop these local community plans. Another solution is for the health plans to update the online resource guides that they have. So each plan has an online guide. And these resource pages will ensure that the MEs, the providers, and discharge planners have quick reference and access to plan-specific information, contracts for the service plans provided, including behavioral health supports, et cetera. So AHCA is actively engaging with the health plans regarding high utilizers. The health plans report high level of engagement with the children identified as high utilizers currently. For each child that is enrolled in a managed care plan, the health plans provide AHCA a list of the interventions implemented for that child and for the family of that child. The most frequently reported strategies include intensive care management, alternative placement in lieu of inpatient stays, and then enhance parental and family support. As for the intensive case management, we know from health plans reporting that about 80% of those Medicaid children who are high utilizers have been assigned a specialized case manager by that plan. And that case manager is responsible for coordinating all aspects of care for that individual. Also, as I mentioned, the health plans use these alternative placements in lieu of the inpatient stay. You know, one intervention that is repeated for repeated admissions into the inpatient is for a placement into a longer term type facility, such as a statewide inpatient psychiatric center or a SIP provider or a therapeutic group home. And looking at these alternatives, we've seen that about 40% of our high utilizers have kind of used this alternative. So the agency also manages what we call the event notification services. It's our ENS system. So ENS subscribers, including more than 300 hospitals, health plans, other providers, with This provides timely notifications about their patient's health care, their encounters such as admits to a hospital, discharge, or transfers. So the way it works is when a patient receives care at a participating healthcare facility, the ENS sends subscribers an alert containing details about the patient's encounter. So although Medicaid health plans are contractually required to subscribe to ENS, CSUs, or crisis stabilization units, are not, and very few of them are subscribers currently. So we're trying to close that gap with the health plans and the CSUs. So we are actively working to encourage the use of ENS among the 59 CSUs that we have in our state. And right now, there are 12 of them that have signed up for the ENS system. We're currently actively working with 13 more, so hopefully soon they're in the process, so they will be signed up. And then the others, we have a whole ENS team that's in a different section of the agency is currently reaching out to them quite frequently to try to get them signed up for this ENS system. With that, I'll turn it back over to Erica.
So I want to talk a little bit about the actions that have been taken by the department and through the use of our managing entities. So the actions that we've taken, so we established a children's care coordination approach, and this is an intensive, highly specialized, individualized activity that uses a face-to-face engagement to provide families, children, and youth to help meet those critical needs at those pivotal times for them. So this activity is facilitated by making sure that there's a single point of contact. The goal is to prevent escalation and to reduce the level of intensity that we see. The goal is to make sure that we can have some mitigation efforts to help reduce the presenting concerns. The care coordinators are working with families to build trust, to establish a rapport with families, and to get them to be engaged in the decision-making process. It's important to encourage participation for them to understand the system of care and the types of services that are available so they can understand what's going on with their child. We felt that this was a most important step to take specifically for those who are high utilizers, because families right now are in crisis and so is their child. So having someone to walk you through that system was most important to us. So with that, the managing entities actually share in the responsibility for the children's care coordination. They provide oversight, they implement, they administer, they also manage the system of care by offering services to all who want to receive the service regardless of their assurance ability or the ability to pay. Now what they do is they have agreements with providers, they have a referral system, memorandum of understanding, but in addition to that, they convene the payers together to be sure to work through things. So they work with TRICARE, Medicaid, other commercial insurers to make sure that they have a seat at the table. They also engage the schools to have the conversations about how do we reduce barriers and make sure that services are being provided. The goal of the Children's Care Coordination is to overcome the systemic barriers to service and to just enable shared information and joint planning efforts to make sure that there's true access to care and there's awareness about care. So the Children's Care Coordination Service was expanded recently by the department to be able to support those families and help again with the navigation process. So as we're doing this, we have developed protocols. So those protocols are being drafted, but they really have just a focus and target approach to make sure that roles and responsibilities are clear, that we are creating linkages. We want to make sure that we are interacting with key stakeholders and that anyone who needs to receive care is able to receive care through this process and has someone to shepherd them through that. Next, I want to speak with you about a pilot project that the department launched. This pilot project was born of many things. So as we were doing the work and identifying the work of House Bill 945, we began working with the Volusia County Sheriff because of concerns that happened in Volusia County. But one of the things that we quickly recognized is that the children that we were examining crossed a number of entities. They crossed from schools, law enforcement, but also our child welfare system, but they also were in Medicaid and in our safety net, but they were high utilizers of services. So they had intense behavioral health needs, but also they had additional needs that we needed to address. So the Volusia pilot was launched in September of this year, of 2021, not this year. And we utilize our new care coordination position with the Volusia County Sheriff. So what we're doing here is having like a co-response. So the Sheriff Department, when they encounter families that are in need, that are in crisis, what they do is they can reach out to the Children's Care Coordinator, who quickly interacts with the families to provide the appropriate resources. We saw that this was helpful. So if the sheriff has to respond to a home if a child is there, they're able to make sure that they provide the appropriate resources for that family regarding behavioral health services. One thing that we identified in this brief pilot was that many times families don't know how to access the behavioral health system of care, and they were reaching out the best way they knew. So they were reaching out to the sheriff department. But through this partnership, we've created a linkage where families are able to be contacted and provided with resources and just appropriate services, helping to overcome some of insurance barriers and financial barriers. So since the inception of the pilot, we've had 61 referrals submitted, and 61 of those families have decided to continue to engage with care coordination. So of that, we have 53 families that have utilized the mobile response team, and most of the families were referred to an integrated practice team. And the integrated practice team is comprised of protective investigators, a community-based care staff, the children's care coordinator, and any other provider that's appropriate to make sure that that family is being assessed and they can be supported in the community. So one of the things that is unique about the pilot is that after this engagement and doing this work, within 2 weeks, they follow up the family to see how they're doing to make sure that their services are in place and if they can do anything else to help them continue in their journey to recovery. So all 53 families that were willing participants after they received resources have participated and appreciated the call within the 2 weeks. One other thing we wanted to highlight was the work that's being done by our managing entity, Lutheran Services of Florida. So Lutheran Services of Florida, they began a family crisis coordination pilot. It was developed to target youth who were frequent utilizers of crisis stabilization services. The goal was to promote and to connect and to stabilize the family, the whole family unit. So this was born out of a number of things. So the department has been examining the work around Baker Acts and involuntariness for minors for years now. So it began the work more focused in 2017 and continued in 2018 and 2019. So during this time, through the partnerships with the managing entities, they also were seeing trends emerge in communities. And of that, one of the things they did was to make sure that they could serve the family at whole. So they provide traditional services, non-traditional services, and develop natural supports. There's a family therapist that's connected to the child to support the entire family. They have parent educators available to provide support. They want to make sure that they can help families increase their knowledge of their child and how to care for their child. They provide counseling services, mentoring programs, educational services, psychological services, medication management, and these services can be provided in the home. So it's a full range of services. They also provide transportation, and they also help to navigate the healthcare system. So as they identify those natural supports, they look at things like coaches, church members, you know, other family members that they can do to be able to think outside the box and have a just creative solution for helping to resolve that, those needs. So one of the things that we are doing as a result of the work around House Bill 945 and the examining what needs to happen next, we've asked ourselves, what can we do to support this work? And at the department, we felt it was important for us to codify and to have it identified in our administrative rule, specifically a term that identifies high utilizers, so everyone can have just some common language to be able to understand who we're referring to when we talk about children. We want to make sure that our policies look at and address discharge planning and specific components that we feel are core to discharge planning to make sure that their appointments are linked, that there's information provided by mobile response teams, that there's awareness about just community resources. So those are things that we are doing as well. We continue to evaluate the way to increase capacity because we know that there is a need for capacity. So a number of these kids find themselves in a situation of crisis because we need to expand our footprint to be able to have community capacity. So we continue to examine that. Another one we were looking at is trying to expand the use of short-term residential services for children. So we thought that this would be a great option for kids who are waiting for placement in a statewide psychiatric inpatient facility. So right now we have 11 statewide and they often have wait lists. So one of the things that emerged from our discussions with our managing entities was to utilize short-term residential treatment in a unique way to be able to support families. So when you are discharged from a crisis, instead of returning home to your family, while as you wait for deeper in care, you are then provided a short-term residential solution until you're able to have a bed made available for you to go to the highest level of care so that you can receive the type of services that are needed. So we'll continue to monitor all of our programs and our pilots, examine the outcomes so that we can determine what we need to do next, if we should expand it statewide.
And then in terms of the, on the Medicaid side, for our next steps, we're going to develop and share best practice information for Medicaid managed care plans to the highlight and promote, identify best practices that are used in Florida and nationally. There are a couple of pilots that we're going to continue to evaluate and monitor, one being the ENS pilot with the health plan to test adding additional data elements so the facilities can share with the health plans and vice versa, you know, such as updated contact information from facilities and service data from the health plans, et cetera. Also, the other pilot we will continue to monitor is the pilot to develop and maximize the use of three behavioral health in lieu of services to reduce emissions in lieu of, meaning that's basically instead of. So a health plan can use a mobile crisis assessment and intervention. That's a service that's in lieu of emergency behavioral health. We also have a high fidelity community-based wraparound, and that's in lieu of SIP placements or therapeutic group home placements. And then lastly, peer support, which is going to be in lieu of psychosocial rehab. So these are things that we're going to be monitoring. And then lastly here, we're going to be looking at policy changes to facilitate the reductions in the emissions that we're seeing. And this would include elements in our upcoming re-procurement. I think everyone's aware that we have a re-procurement of our statewide Medicaid managed care plans. The current contracts expire at the end of 2024. And so we're gearing up and getting ready for that re-procurement process. And in there, we're going to look at things potentially such as requiring high utilizers be assigned to a case management, set case management ratios for different high utilizers, require interaction with the DCF's care coordinators, require health plan intervention in primary care who have high utilizers, and then also here looking at specific reporting related to these crisis stabilization units. And with that, that concludes our presentation.
Thank you. I'm writing notes, so I'm sure everybody else is as well. So we'll have some questions. Please feel free to direct your questions to either Secretary Walz or Secretary Thomas, and obviously you'll let them know which one you're talking to. I think if you'd like to go ahead and stay in your seats, because those mics should be live in front of you, that'll be easier. That way you're not hopping up and down all the time. And I know you may want the workout, but we don't want you to push the chair over or something. So, Representative Soroy, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and good morning. And I want to start by thanking you, Madam Chair, and the presenters for this incredible and eye-opening presentation this morning. I do have two questions, if I may, and I'll ask the first.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my research relates to, or my question relates to research and trends and the data that you referred to. And I'd like to provide a brief context for my question, and then maybe you can help me understand the data. Over the summer, you know, and it's hard to look at these reports about mental health and our data without thinking about the reports over the summer related to the social media effects on body image and eating disorders and how these algorithm-based platforms are affecting the mental health, particularly of young women and girls. And as a father of a little girl, I'm deeply troubled by that. So I'm curious if the data that you have available on diagnosis can drill down into root causes to understand exactly where some of these Baker Act issues are coming from.
Whichever one of you would like to tackle that one. Representative Thomas? No? She's. I thought you looked eager. So
thank you.
I called you Representative. Did I call you Representative Thomas? Secretary Thomas.
Thank you. So in response to your question, our data does provide us with a lot of detail And we would love to get to the cause and the course of that. And we don't have that level of detail that they would share with their clinician. However, we are doing the same thing that you're doing, examining trends, trying to figure out how to get upstream, making sure that we can prevent and make sure that our children have just really good self-esteem and good self-image. So we're looking at just mental health promotion campaigns about just overall wellness and well-being.
Follow-up question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that answer. And, you know, as policymakers, whatever you can do to equip us with the tools to go out and drive those numbers down, you know, I hope that the goal is in the future those numbers come down because of actions that we've taken. And I look forward to meeting with you to continue the conversation. My second question, and thank you, Madam Chair, is with regard to the resources that are provided to families that have gone through this Baker Act experience with a child, and I think you were referring to the pilot program in Volusia County. Could you elaborate further on the resources that are left with a parent that's had a child that has been Baker Acted? Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're recognized.
Thank you. So the resources that they provide are things like giving them access to a mobile response team, making them aware that the mobile response team is available for them if they call to help de-escalate a crisis situation, providing information about like mentorship programs, you know, like the Federation of Families, talking about peer support for kids to be able to have that, treatment services, assessments. So it has a full range of things that are being provided to those families to make sure that they are able to be connected. Also offering them some resources they can receive during the school day, things that are provided after school. So it's a whole host of things. Oftentimes families are not aware of like the full array of things that can be provided and some community partnerships.
Thank you. Representative Duran, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you both for being here. I wanted to start on the Medicaid side. I think there was a slide 28, that you showed some of the barriers. And I think one of those included not enough participation, or I'm not sure if you can clarify with the provider or the care provider. Do we have any idea why or what those barriers are that the care provider's participation may be in providing this care to these children?
All right, thank you, and thank you for that question. We know all of our managed care plans have care coordinators and case managers that are assigned to an individual. All right, so they're assigned to, like I said here, there's sometimes that the family of the member is not wanting that care coordinator to have full interaction with that high utilizer. So we see that as probably the biggest barrier that we have here. So the managed care plans, you know, are working with us. We're trying to think about ways to work around that currently. But that is a big issue.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do we know if there's any sort of record of or any issue that's been mentioned about the reimbursement, I imagine, for those who are providing this care, if it's low or too low or anything of that sort of sense that might be driving some lack of providers in the system?
You're recognized.
Yeah. Thank you for that question. Regarding this, I haven't really had any interactions with the health plans on this topic or the providers discussing about reimbursement issues. We hear about reimbursement all the time. Now, that's a big deal. I mean, that's one of the first things that came up in preparing for this presentation and looking at this and thinking through things. That wasn't something that we had really discussed.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
You're recognized, sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the other question I had, it's not really a question. Is it possible maybe in follow-up we could get some data on 2021? Only reason I ask that is because when you look at 2020, we all know that's the start of the pandemic. It may be related to folks just staying away, just like in preventative care, a lot of people stayed away from going to the doctor. Just kind of curious maybe what 2021 numbers might look like. But I guess my question is on the mobile response units, I've heard a lot from folks in the school system and around that it seems like we have, when it comes to access points and entry points to those providers, that we may not have enough. Just kind of maybe you can give me some comments on if you're hearing that they're stretched thin, or we need to think more about the mobile rapid response units and how we might be able to help support them with more capacity, more assistance on that end.
You're both recognized to answer that question, because I'd be interested, quite frankly, to hear from both your perspectives.
So thank you. Thank you for the question. So our mobile response teams definitely are very impactful. As with everyone, as there's greater awareness about behavioral health services, we see that services are being more highly utilized, specifically services that help people remain out of crisis. So the mobile response team, you know, coming on site and providing care, they are, you know, a valuable resource. So when you have a valuable resource, there's always opportunity to expand the footprint to make sure that more individuals can be served.
Secretary Walz.
Yeah, thank you. And just to add to what Erica mentioned here, I mean, we have looked across the state to see where these mobile crisis units are and where they're located. We've been working with our managing entities and the Association of Managing Entities around this. So this is something we're starting to work on, and we'll work with DCF too as we move forward in this process.
Thank you. Representative Masullo, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have two questions also.
You're recognized for me. More than one and question.
The first one dovetails with Representative Durand's question about the decrease on slide 9 from 2019 to 20. Also, those children weren't in school a good portion of that year to where they would not be recognized of any sort of behavior that would necessitate a Baker Act. So I think 2021 numbers are very important, particularly for this committee, even though they may be just estimates at this time and not audited, so we can plan a little bit more thoroughly what we might do in the future. My second question that I wanted to ask is, have you all recognized any variables regarding family dynamics for these people that become more frequently Baker acted, for instance, those coming from a single parent family as opposed to two parents, those coming from foster care, where you might identify a higher risk to those individuals and be able to give them a little bit more extensive care? You know, our main goal is to decrease the number of Baker acts, and to do that, we need better results for the individuals that are being Baker acted.
You're recognized.
Yeah, thank you. And I'll start off. Maybe you want to add to it, Erica. But I couldn't agree with you more, Representative. Thank you for that question. Couldn't we agree with you more that we understand that it really starts with the family on a lot of these kids and getting in there and seeing what we can do with the family to help them out. These are all things that we are discussing, and we are working with our managed care plans to see what we can do about that.
Secretary Thomas, do you have a response as well?
Yes. So, to your point, for the family really does need to be supported in those instances. What we saw with the pilot that was being done by LSF is that the family oftentimes is in crisis and the child is acting out the pain of the family. So by providing those family supports and offering that therapy, it has been beneficial to help to stabilize the entire family unit. So we are continuing to examine that data to understand how to move forward.
Just one quick follow-up.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My main question was, have you been able to identify variables within the family unit? For instance, what percent of those children come from single-parent families? What percent of those children come from two-parent families or foster families? Then that you could concentrate efforts to say, all right, this child is going to be at a higher risk than this child for the same behavior.
You're recognized.
Thank you. So I would definitely have to work with the managing entities that are having that pilot to see specifically if they've looked at variables such as those. I think their focus really was mostly on identifying the children who were utilizing their services, wrapping those families around support. But we can definitely go back and talk about looking at the data from that perspective to see if there were some things that stood out that would make it more likely that care would be required.
Representative Koster, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And a couple of my, I have three questions.
All right. Nobody more than three. Okay, you're ready.
Thank you, Chair. And
you can come back if you come up with more than three.
Sure, I appreciate that. Two of them sort of dovetail on what Dr. Masullo was asking. And the first one I think is a fairly simple one. So what was the time frame? You guys referenced 180-day time frame. Do you know what months of the year that time frame was that we pulled the data? Because I'm curious, like Dr. Masullo sort of alluded to, if part of that 180 days was during summer break or winter break or when the children are not in school. I'm just curious if you know what the time frame was.
Whichever one would you like to answer that is recognized?
So the data that we represented was the 2020 calendar year. And so the 180 days that reference was for those who had Baker Acts, you know, within more than a six-month period. But it was the entire calendar year of 2020 that we examined. And then some of the data that was displayed was the calendar year for 2019.
Okay, so I think maybe I misunderstood. So you weren't examining a 180-day period necessarily. It was just, okay, understood, thank you. My second question, I think, is for Secretary Wallace, dealing with, you said one of the biggest barriers is the family's willingness to participate in the care, the continuous care. And I'm curious what we're doing to make it feel voluntary for these families, because these families that are in crisis, probably their unwillingness to participate is their fear of having their children removed from their care and put into foster care, assuming that they're not already in that situation. So I'm curious how we approach the families to make this feel like a voluntary, we're here to work with you and help, rather than sort of government coming in and saying, you know, we're going to take your kid. Sort of situation.
You're recognized.
Yep, thank you, and thank you for that question. So we have, as I mentioned, you know, with our managed care plans, they have care coordinators that's supposed to manage that care of that individual. And so they're the ones that are following along the path of any services that that individual needs along with that member the whole time. So I would have to really talk to them to figure out exactly what the managed care plans are doing in the situation that you just brought up, how they go about that and that approach. But those are the things that you bring up that we're working with the plans on a, you know, go-forming basis for sure.
Good.
Great. And my last question, I think, is simple, again, for Secretary Wallace. What is preventing these entities that are not using the ENS system that you talked about, what's preventing them from doing so? Because it seems like such a simple... You know, obviously it's only one tool in the toolbox, but it seems like such a simple thing. What's preventing these folks from signing up?
You're recognized.
Yep, thank you, and thank you for that question. We're doing outreach. We're trying to get them to sign up. There is a cost associated with it. I mean, that's a potential barrier. There is a cost. I know our staff that run the system, the ENS system, they've looked at working with the entities to try to lower that cost a little bit. And I think it might just be to just get them more information out to them, what this does, the benefits of this program. And these are all things that we're currently in process of doing.
Representative Rayner, you recognize?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I only have one question.
Okay.
I will try to be brief. So thank you so much for your presentation. This is an area that I'm passionate about. And I want to kind of... touch base on what Representative Soroy said, and I believe you mentioned it in your answer. With regard to social media, I know that that's something that in my household is talked about a lot. My wife does a lot of work with social media prevention with children, but you talked about preventative campaigns like for mental health. Can you kind of talk a little bit more about that, what you have done or what you are planning to do, especially as we're seeing from, you know, the pandemic, children are on social media more and more, and we've been seeing a lot of, you know, kind of just really difficult things happening because of their interaction on social media. So could you speak to that for me, please?
You're recognized.
Yeah. So we do have a number of campaigns that we have, just general awareness campaigns, but our managing entities are our partners who put forth that information to make sure that that information can be globally shared about just how do you approach care, understanding what services are available, and focus on suicide prevention, things of that nature, so that it's a broad range of topics. Sometimes we have things where we borrow materials that we get from our partners at SAMHSA that have billboards that we can use that can demonstrate and display things about like substance use disorder. So the range of material is very vast and wide.
Good. Thank you. Representative Buchanan, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe two questions? Thank you. Great
under
presentation.
Three.
Thank
three
you guys.
I gave you my extra question.
Appreciate that. Thank you guys for being here today. I imagine this would probably be directed at Secretary Thomas. What factors or criteria currently go into the allocation formula for community-based lead agency allocation? And when was that formula last revisited?
You recognize.
So thank you for asking me that question. So for the allocations, I would definitely have to lean on our budget folks to be able to respond to that. So I'll have to get that information back to you.
Okay. Do you have
just one follow-up?
Related to the topic of the presentation or another budget question?
It's just a comment, if I may, Madam.
Certainly.
Chair. Thank you. Appreciate that, and I look forward to that conversation because it has been brought to our local delegation's attention that this is a formula that we may want to take a closer look at, especially in light of current events and the more recent opiate crisis. So I look forward to that conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative F. Robinson, you are recognized for questions related to the presentation, please.
Most definitely.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And again, thank you all for this presentation. My question is real quick, and you kind of touched on it before. It's about the mobile response team. I guess, do we have any data on how perceptive the parents and the families are to actually using it? We know that it's a good program and it's a really great resource, but do we have the numbers of how many of them actually take advantage of it?
You're both recognized, so whichever one would like to answer that.
So if we do have mobile response team data about utilization. I'm not sure. I guess we could look to see if we're able to determine who initiated the use of the mobile response team. We know how, like, a call would originate, but that's data we can get back to you. Okay. But we definitely do track the utilization across the state.
Just one follow-up. Well, kind of a follow-up. It's not even a question.
Certainly, you recognize.
But because I'm an educator, and I know a lot of times we have the resources, but when we offer them to the parents or whatever, they're kind of sometimes hesitant. So I just want to kind of hone down on, we have this great resource. How many of them are actually using it and taking advantage of it?
That's a great question.
Thank you. Additional questions? You're good? Okay. Representative Davis, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And I do have three.
Yes, ma'am.
Good morning, and thank you all for being here. Just some generally broad questions. How much overlap in services do you see between the mental health providers using in your managed care plans and the DCF entities, if you know that?
You recognize?
Thank you. And I can say that, you know, if you remember one of the earlier slides that Erica had presented to you, she said that there were, you know, individuals that crossed back between both programs. So they will have some throughout the year that would be receiving Medicaid services and then also receiving DCF services. So those individuals would be in our managed care plans, but the percentage and the amount of services on each, I don't have that information with me right now, but that's something we can look into for you.
Thank you.
Additional, you're recognized.
Yes. Are most of your mental health providers participating in the both of the networks, your managed care network, as well as your DCF entities?
You're recognized.
Thank you, and thank you for that question. Yes, we the managed care plans have to have network ratios and meet network requirements, and we monitor that and make sure the plans have their mental health networks together. If the managed care plans do not meet those network requirements, we do have liquidated damage that we do assess against them, so that is something we monitor.
Okay, and last question.
You're recognized.
Thank you. So just curious, in looking at the presentation, what reducing the frequency of, I guess, the Medicaid eligibility redeterminations reduce the number of children bouncing back between the two networks of your care, managed care plans versus DCF, if you have that ability?
You're recognized.
Thank you for that question. I'm not sure I'm quite following exactly saying what you're referring to.
If you are reducing the amount of Medicaid eligibility requirements, that redetermination that's going on between the entities, if you were able to reduce that back and forth movement between the entity and the managed care plans, would that reduce the amount of situations or Baker Acts that we're having?
You're recognized.
Got it. I understand what you're saying here. Honestly, I'm not real sure. I don't know if that would reduce it or not. Again, that goes back to your first question, I think, too, kind of looking at that data to see how many and what the volume is of that, and that's something we can look at and get back to you.
Representative Skidmore, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. My first question is actually very similar to Representative Davis's question. I'm curious as to how Florida Medicaid compares to other states in terms of this particular topic. And if in states that have Medicaid expansion, does that stabilize the bouncing of children, as their status may change and they're Medicaid eligible and not Medicaid eligible? Do you have any trends or statistics that compare Florida's situation to other states?
You're recognized.
Thank you. I don't have any of that comparison data with me today, but that's something we can kind of look at. I can go back and check with the team to see if that's something that they have readily available to share, but I don't have it here.
Second question, Madam Chair.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My second question is that I'm looking at the high utilizer data. The majority had six or fewer admissions. 21% had between 7 and 12 admissions, and the remaining 7% had 13 or more. What is the protocol for ensuring that 72% or all those who are not the high utilizers are getting enough services? Because it seems like the focus is on your presentation is on the high utilizers. But for those who are entering into the system, what is the plan and the protocol for making sure they don't become the high utilizers?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Well, that slide that I mentioned here and that those numbers you state here, these are all considered in our definition of high utilizers. So anyone from a 3 up within that 180-day period is considered a high utilizer. Now, below a 3, so someone could have had a 2 within 102 CSU visits within a 6 month. We had not considered that as a high utilizer for our definition is 3 and above. So these folks have already become that. And so then when they're already here, this is where we're working with our managed care plans to do all those things that we're talking about.
Follow up to that.
You're recognized.
Thank you. So thank you for that answer. What is being done for the folks who fall, the children who fall under the high utilization threshold?
You're recognized.
Thank you. They continue to get same services that they all get, right? So they get Medicaid services. They have access to, they have care coordinators, case managers as well. So everyone's associated with the case manager. So their services are being looked at too. They just haven't reached that point of being considered and deemed a high utilizer, which we have a real focus on those individual high utilizers.
Representative Tant, you recognize?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions, if that's okay.
And you're recognized.
I won't belabor. So I am very familiar. I work very closely with with Appalachian Mental Health here in Tallahassee with Dr. Jay Reeve, who I think is a local just rock star with mental health. I just really rely on him on all of these issues. I'm also very familiar with the peer-to-peer program that has been launched for first responders. Are we using peer-to-peer programs for parents to parents? Is that utilized also that they can be assured that their children are okay through these programs? When you talk about peer-to-peer, I was just wondering if that was part of it.
You recognize.
Yes, yeah, so that's a component of the work that's being done, is making sure that there's a family peer, but there's also an adolescent peer. So that's part of that, to make sure that we have those linkages there.
Thank you. Follow up, Madam Chair?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So one of the things, Leon County Schools, about this time last 2 years ago, had a pretty big uptick in Bakeracting of children, school children. And largely it was because of the resource officers calling in Bakeracting, and a family who's a constituent of mine who went to a private school was called and said, your daughter, 5 years old, is about to be picked up by law enforcement. If you get here before they get here, you might be able to stop the child from being put in the back of the police car. They've had counseling through the roof since then. In working through that with Appalachee, one of the things that we spoke about, and I was very impressed with the Volusia Project about the training, so that it's not an automatic, easy response for a resource officer who really doesn't have a background in mental health and doesn't necessarily need to or should, but should have some training in how to make sure that we're not inappropriately putting folks in Bakeracting, children in the back of a vehicle for a Bakeract. Dr. Reeves suggested that we actually obviously send in a mobile crisis unit, and then before any decisions about admissions, have a telehealth review. Is that a possibility? Is that wrapped into any of your plans to have telehealth review by a licensed professional who could then assist with the situation on site to avoid a worse crisis for a family?
You're recognized.
Thank you. That is one of the tools that I utilize, is using telehealth and the mobile response team to be able to address that. So that is a part of the component of that work.
Thank you. Follow up, Madam Chair. How frequent is that? Because I noticed in your presentation there's only 11 mobile crisis units statewide. So how are we able to expand that, and what are we doing to expand that?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So we were examining our allocation dollars and looking to see where we can expand our footprint. We have a unique opportunity right now where we're looking at the supplemental block grant dollars that have been afforded to the department to see if we can expand the reach of the mobile response teams.
So I'll follow up, Madam Chair, and that'll be my last thing. I first want to say thank you for doing this work. Your presentation today just is heartbreaking to think about these children and their families, and so I'm really grateful for the work you're doing. I did, when you talk about looking at funding available, I did read that there were funds from the American Rescue Plan that we could apply for. Have we applied for any of those grants yet to expand mobile crisis units?
You're recognized.
We haven't specifically applied for mobile response units. However, we do have supplemental block grant dollars that can be applied for a broad range of services, which includes the mobile response teams and the use of telehealth.
Thank you. And that
Representative Persons Malika, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I only have two.
Thank you.
Two questions. Secretaries Wallace and Thomas, thank you both for being here. And I want to personally thank you and your team's work that you do on a daily basis on this and so many other critical issues to our state, especially those who are on the ground dealing with the families and the children. My questions revolve around the whole theme of de-escalation prior to being Bakeracted, and they kind of follow up on Representative Tant's question. My first question is in regards to the data that you're collecting regarding the Bakeracts. Are you collecting data regarding who or from where the Bakeract is being initiated? For example, are the children being Bakeracted from a school setting or from a home setting or from some other type of community setting? And if that data is available, I would love to see that.
You're recognized. Whichever one of you would like to answer.
So our Bakeract data definitely has specific information about who was the initiating person for the Bakeract, but I definitely have to go back and look to see if we can tell where the originating site was. Because we do have a Bakeract form, and I'm not really clear on all the components, but that is something for us to look into as we refine that to be able to have to glean better data to understand the system.
Certainly. Any additional? Okay. Additional questions?
Thank you for, and as my second question, when a child is being Baker Acted from a, let's say, a school setting, a setting that is not the parent or guardian's home, when in the process of the Baker Act is that parent or guardian first initiated or becomes first involved in the process, as they often will have information regarding not only the child's history, but who the clinicians are that the child may work with that would help de-escalate?
You recognize?
During that process, the family should be immediately notified so that that information can be gleaned. So that's the best case scenario. I don't know if that happens in every case, but the family should be contacted and informed immediately so that you're able to do just what you described.
Thank you. Representative Brown, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll be very brief because many of the questions I had came from Representative Mizzullo and my colleague that's right next to him, dealing with the data. More specifically, because I brought this bill 2017, due to issues that were going on in the home, and unfortunately their mom passed or was killed by her son due to no resources being provided at that particular time. So it's great to hear this morning that this, you've even included an additional pilot. But this good work is still going on to help many of these families. Just to kind of piggyback on, but again, would love to follow up more so with the data. But I know at that time in 17 when we did this bill, we were unable to, there were no resources with DCF, but there were resources through DJJ. And so the program had to go through their funding. Has there been any communication among the two agencies relating to data? Has there been exchange of information through them or even through the domestic violence organization? Has there been data collected from them, being that they, at the time, the training with the sheriff's office and funding for the additional resources for those parents were done through them originally? Has there been any data collected from them to also go along with the information you've been collecting over the past few years?
You're recognized.
Thank you for that question. Unfortunately, I do not have that information, but I can definitely ask my team. But I do know that Secretary Harris has been working very closely with the DJJ, the secretary, to make sure that there's just shared information across the board as we try to take care of all of Florida's children.
Thank you. Representative Altman, you're recognized. You're good? Additional questions? Leader Grant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. One quick question. Do we know what the average cost of a Baker Act admission is for a child?
You're both recognized. You've ever liked to answer that?
Thank you for that. I do not have that information on me, but I can work with DCF here and get that. We can get that back to you. Yeah.
Thank you. Additional questions? Okay. Well, thank you both for not just your presentations. You spent more time answering questions than you had in your presentations, but certainly they were the springboard to many of these questions. We're good on questions, and also thank you for, both of you said you'll follow back up. So if you provide follow-up information on any of these questions and you provide them to our staff, we'll make sure all the members of our committee have that information. That's always helpful. Correct. So this concludes our committee meeting agenda. Representative Davis moves we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you. Okay.